Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and join our blog at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club and moderator for tonight's program. Please join me in thanking Pitch and Kathy Johnson, who I just saw enter the room there, for generously underwriting tonight's program. Thank you, Pitch and Kathy. For the past several years, the relationship between the U.S. and Russia has traveled a bumpy road, with dust-ups over the war in Iraq and missile defense in Eastern Europe, and differing approaches to dealing with Iran's nuclear aspirations, conflicts in the Caucasus, and many other issues. At the outset of this new administration, Vice President Biden spoke of pressing the reset button with Russia. So there was hope that the U.S. might start to apply more creative effort in trying to move the U.S.-Russian relationship onto a productive track. But as the economic crisis deepened, it riveted the attention of both the new administration and the media, so this relationship of key importance for the U.S. seemed again to move to the back burner. But a great deal is actually happening or about to happen in U.S.-Russian relations, driven in part by the urgent need to move ahead with the Russians in areas such as strategic nuclear arms control. The new administration has many of its Russia policymakers in place. Several of those are from Stanford and are known to many of you. They've often shared this stage here at the Commonwealth Club. Within the administration, various strategies for pushing the reset button with Russia are being proposed and debated. Into this environment has now come a very thoughtful and perceptive study from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is working to formulate a comprehensive, coherent, and integrative U.S. strategy towards Russia. The timing of the study could not be better to assist and advise the members of the new administration as they attempt to take us in new directions with the Russians. It gives me particular pleasure this evening to introduce Dr. Robert Legvold, a distinguished expert on Russia and international relations and director of the American Academy's Project on U.S. Policy Towards Russia. Dr. Legvold is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Science at Columbia University, where he specialized in the international relations of the post-Soviet states. He was for many years director of Columbia's Harriman Institute for the Advanced Study of Russia and Eurasia. Prior to going to Columbia in 1984, he served for 6 years as senior fellow and director of the Soviet Studies Project at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He holds a doctorate from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and is the author of many books, including most recently Russian Foreign Policy in the 21st Century and the Shadow of the Past, published in 2007, and Georgia After the Rose Revolution, published in 2005. Dr. Legvold is a trustee of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and was recently elected a foreign member of the Russian Academy of Social Sciences. Now Dr. Legvold will begin tonight's program with an overview of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Russia Initiative. Bob?
Gloria, thank you very much. It could not be a greater pleasure for me to be here, not only because Gloria is a long-standing friend for many years, but also because of the importance of the Commonwealth Club in California broadly. When we have looked for settings where we could bring the issue of Russia to a broader audience's attention, that is, of the engaged public, our first choice was the Commonwealth Club in California, so we're very pleased that we're here this evening. As Gloria said, the U.S.-Russia relationship is at something of a low point, which is not to say that it couldn't go lower if things are not changed at this point. Low enough so that I would say it's at its worst in 20 years. You'd have to go back to the period before Gorbachev came to power in 1985 to find a moment when the mood on both sides, but particularly on Russia's side, was as sour, as negative, as skeptical as you find these days in Russia. But as Gloria said, there are signs that at least the new U.S. administration wants to see whether this can be turned around and whether we can have a more constructive relationship with Russia. The project that I'm associated with and to which Gloria referred is something that we began last April, long before we knew the outcome of the election. And at that point, the key issue was overcoming the inertia in this country. This project is about us. It's not about the Russians as such. We would hope there will be parallel efforts on their part. And inertia at all levels, within an administration, within a Congress, within the media, within the body politic, more broadly. And it turns out that after the election, the inertia at that critical level within the administration has disappeared. The administration's an open door. The administration wants to change things with Russia and has already taken major steps in that direction. As a matter of fact, although it's not yet in the public, as they go through their strategic reviews, Russia is one of three countries where they are far advanced, which is in turn something of a representation of the priority they're giving to Russia. The other two countries, will not surprise you, are Iran and Afghanistan. But when we come to the major powers, the country that the new administration is beginning to focus on is Russia, and rightly so. Because in U.S. relations with major powers, China, Japan, the Europeans, there's no relationship that's more vexed or more troubled than the one with Russia. And yet it's a relationship where the stakes are very high, much higher than I think most within the policy community, within the Congress, and I think broadly, certainly within the media and those of us who consume it, are unaware of. That is just how ramified and how important the stakes are in the relationship. They start with the issues that you're aware of and that Gloria alluded to, nuclear weapons, 95% of which are still in the hands of the United States and Russia, and therefore what happens to a world that tries to regulate them or control them depends very much on U.S. and Russia leadership, not the least because that 95% is split almost 50-50, and that in turn is crucial to whether we make any progress in dealing with nonproliferation and the tough cases on the road to improving the position on nonproliferation like Iran and North Korea. Also, energy. I can't imagine there's anyone in this room that doesn't recognize the importance of Russia as an energy supplier and therefore the need for a constructive relationship between Russia and the United States in this area. 30% of the world's gas reserves, 30% of the supply of gas and nearly as much of the oil for Europe, our major allies in this area. But what I think people often don't focus on is how broad, that is how ramified the stakes are. The nuclear area, the energy, that's very important. And if we are at odds with one another in addressing these questions, it's going to be a much less happy, a much less safe, a much less constructive world. But it goes beyond that. Take something like global warming that this administration, or climate change that this administration is now focused on and is going to take a different approach. It'll need Russia, because Russia, along with China and the United States, is the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases. And as John Kerry, Senator Kerry, at a major conference that we had in Washington said on Friday, it's not just in this area the greenhouse gases are a basic problem, but if you link it to a next problem, which is access to the Arctic resources, the issue comes home both in terms of the potential tension over the claims for hydrocarbons in that area, which is already becoming a military issue. A part of Russia's military reform is designed to create a military capacity for defending their interests off the continental shelf in the Arctic. And the Norwegians in August ran a large exercise with 12 nations, NATO members, in order to, from their end, militarily uphold their positions in these contested claims to the hydrocarbons under the Arctic. At a minimum, estimated at 13% of the world's reserves in essential hydrocarbons, some figures go higher than that. But if I link it back to climate change, it is something like the equivalent, the methane gases under the Arctic, which are far more dangerous than the carbon dioxide, are something like 20% of the world's supply of methane. If that process is not regulated. And then you go on to other things, illicit trade. Illicit trade in everything from trafficked humans to endangered species. And the volume of endangered species traffic today is twice the volume of small arms, illegal arms transfer in international politics. Russia is a critical player in this area. Drugs, heroin out of Afghanistan. 60% of Europe's supply comes through that chain through Russia. And on almost any area of illicit trade, counterfeit goods, money laundering, Russia and its neighbors, because it's not just a Russia problem, Ukraine and the others are a critical part of the problem. So it is crucial that all of us, we, the alert public, our congresspeople, and the administration recognize that there's a very good reason, in fact, a vast list of reasons by which we want to turn this decline, this deterioration relations, and in free fall as a collapse since the August War around. How one might go about that, what it is that we're thinking about in the project, is what I'm here to talk about tonight. So I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you, Bob. Do you want to tell us anything about the process of this review that you're chairing at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences? There are various working groups, and what are the topic areas?
Well, from the beginning, we wanted to involve as many people that are our professional counterparts as we could in useful ways. So there were actually four groups at the outset that contributed. As I said, the project began last April, so much of this was over the summer and then through the first month in September. There was a group in Moscow at the Carnegie Moscow Center that held a 12-part series on the security dimension of U.S.-Russia relations, heavily nuclear, but also conventional forces, and even some of the problems in Southeast Asia. Second group was in Washington, a working group that focused on a broader range of issues with a number of ex-policymakers, some in the Russia area, some in the general foreign policy area, academics, as well as I've said, former government types, that focused, as I said, on a broader set of issues, six meetings. A third group that was focused on the economic dimension of the relationship, which has now obviously become very important because of the potential impact of the economic crisis on Russia, both its internal choices and how it'll behave in the outside world. That was a six-part series led under the auspices of the Center for Strategic International Studies and the senior Russia specialist there. And then the fourth group was the ambassadors group, because Jim Collins, an ex-ambassador to the Soviet Union in Russia, ambassador to Russia, but many years of service in the Soviet Union, has assembled all of the former ambassadors from the Soviet Union to the U.S. and all of the U.S. ambassadors to the Soviet Union in Russia, and they've been meeting at various points. Their task in the project was to think about how you work on structure in the bilateral relationship, because that's what they had seen most closely. All that reporting was done by late October to a steering group. And our steering group has been, I'll list the names without saying too much. You'll recognize some of the names. Strobe Talbott, now the head of Brookings, but close to President Clinton and the senior person in that administration. Chip Blacker, whom you know from the Stanford area, who had been the senior figure at the NSC under Clinton. Tom Graham, who's now with Kissinger Associates, but who had been the senior figure in the last Bush administration, that is the senior special assistant on Russia, and has been with Henry Kissinger on all of the recent trips, the Kissinger-Primakov things, including a week ago for meetings with Medvedev and Putin. If you're interested in how those meetings went, we can talk about that. Rose Gottemuller, who headed the Moscow Center, and who will now be the lead START negotiator and the Assistant Secretary for Arms Control and Verification. Angela Stent, former NIO, National Intelligence Officer, senior faculty member at Georgetown. Eugene Rumer, senior figure from the State Department planning staff and now on the faculty at the National Defense University. I may have left somebody out, but that's the steering group. Very quickly, rather than issuing a single task force report, and then sailing it off in the ether in hopes that somebody will pay attention to it, have instead tried to do individual pieces that we thought would be useful to an administration and to a Congress. So a fair amount of what we've done has been private in the specific recommendations that we've made, including the conduct of a strategic dialogue, the idea of a far-reaching strategic dialogue with the Russians that you may want to talk about. We can come back to that, what's involved, some thoughts about a presidential address on Russia. And then we've been working with, and we started it as a way of formulating our own thinking or focusing our own thinking, a PowerPoint presentation that's in two parts, one, a broad basic strategic assessment, and I would be happy to share that with you, Gloria, and people that may be interested in looking at that, because what it's really intended to do is create a basic assessment of the relationship, overlapping interests, conflicting interests, where we'd want the relationship to be 4 to 6 years from now, that kind of thing. And then it leaves you at the end with this question, okay, now what do you want to do about it if this is the way we lay out the problem? The second part is a detailed description of what we would want to do about it, that is a policy framework. That's going to be, I think, more dense than most within even the alert public is going to be interested in. And there are a series of other individual things that we've done as well that are issued. Some of them include things like testimony I gave before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, articles that members of our steering committee have written, Strobe Talbot's Weizsäcker lecture in Berlin a few weeks ago, all of which is in the public domain. There's an immense amount of material now, I finish with this, an immense amount of material that has been generated in the last 2 or 3 months that is broad-gauged, focused on what's wrong with the relationship, what needs to be done with specific policy recommendations. And I must say the vast majority of it is more or less moving along similar lines.
I should note, we will post whatever material is made available to us, which includes Dr. Legvold's February 25th testimony before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and anything else he would like to give us on the Commonwealth Club's website at that blogspot address, commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. So you can access that. Maybe we'll provide some links to the American Academy site. So we'll make some of that material available. I should also mention that Dr. Coit Blacker was going to be with us this evening. You mentioned him, and he's indisposed this evening and couldn't join us. I'd like to start just by working through some of the major issues in U.S.-Russian relations for your take on them, comments about the conclusions of the working groups you've been working with, or just your own individual assessment. And I'll start with a question that comes from the audience. It was also high on my list. How has Russia been affected by the current economic crisis? What are the opportunities for cooperation in this area?
Russia has been affected as much, if not more, than virtually any of the major industrialized economies. Great Britain may be the only one that has a right to compete on that score, alas. And it depends on how you want to measure it. In terms of the macro statistics, and I think this is probably the way in which it'll matter most, their aspiration for a development plan they'd laid out for the year 2020, which is a 280-page projection of how they done in the past year, long before the crisis, how they meant to develop their country and through innovation, posed a target of around 7% a year growth. The estimates now from the IMF for next year is an 8% deficit, negative growth for the country. And that is likely not at 8%, but it's likely to continue for the next several years. So the first effect is that their overall plan is going to be thrown vastly a kilter in the near term. The second is the immediate pressure within the country in terms of the relationship between the society and the leadership. Some people talk about a social contract. Even one of the very bright counselors to President Medvedev has referred to the social contract, the deal that was struck, that is, we'll tolerate constraint on our civil liberties in turn for the good economic times that were provided after 1998. That has been sundered by the effect of the crisis. The expectation is that they may reach as much as 10 million unemployed this year and into next year. They're at 6 million right now, even though that's not the official figure. Medvedev in public the other day confessed that was the case. And in his interview with the BBC this week, he has said that they've had an additional 200,000 that lost their job in the last couple of months. It's not quite the rates that we're seeing in the U.S., but it's felt because these people had expected within the population real boom times. There are lots of other measures that I won't go into so that this can be a briefer response. The important thing is what effect will it have on their behavior? The first thing I would say is that I think most people who look at Russia believe that Russia today is more unpredictable because of this than it was before September, because at least hypothetically, it could go one of two directions. If the crisis were to deepen, it's possible the regime, in order to anticipate or preempt social unrest, would become even more repressive or would deal with social unrest in a more repressive way, and in foreign policy would become still more assertive or still more petulant and churlish, even perhaps looking for external enemies or scapegoats to blame it on. That's one alternative. The other is that, on the contrary, it will need to find a different kind of a deal with the public, and that it'll have to be more accommodating, have to communicate more clearly, have to look as though it respects the interests of the public and their participation more directly, and in foreign policy become more accommodative. My own prediction, don't ask me to put much of my retirement account on it, but my own prediction is the second. And the signs are that's the way it's going for the moment. But what makes it unpredictable is that's in the present circumstance. And if the crisis grows very deep, and from their point, at the moment they think it's manageable. In fact, they think they've now stabilized the ruble, which is what they used about a third of their reserves on. They had the world's third largest reserves. They used about a third of those in order to stabilize the ruble. It looks as though they have at this point. And they would argue, Dvorkovich, the key advisor, one of the key advisors to Medvedev, and a very sensible economist, has said this week that he thinks they're through the worst of it. There are lots of others who are saying no. My point is that were this all wrong, and were this to deepen seriously, and most of us in any of our countries don't know where all of this is going, and it looked as though it was unmanageable, then my wagers are off.
Are the U.S. and Russia working together in any way on the economic crisis? Is there potential there for collaboration?
There should be. Russia, at the end of the day, when it comes to a G20, is still a minor player. We know who the key figures will be for the U.S. in London this week. It begins with China. It's no accident that the administration, when it creates a major dialogue with China, is going to conduct that dialogue between Tim Geithner, the Secretary of Treasury, and Secretary of State Clinton. Whatever kind of a dialogue we have with Russia, it will not the key partner will not be Geithner. And at the G20, even though the Russians are tying their cart to the Chinese on a series of things, the idea of at some point in the future a new reserve currency as an alternative to the major currencies, including the dollar, and a number of the other ideas will be there. I think the more practical answer to your question, Gloria, is not in what ways do we really need Russia in order to address the global economic crisis. Our key partners will be Japan, China, and the Europeans, without question. But the degree to which the relationship between the United States and Russia needs the U.S. to reach out and make it plain that we are going to take account of Russia's concerns, not always agreeing with what the Russians want to argue, because it is the central issue for them. And if it looks as though we're washing our hands of the Russians or ignoring them entirely in this context, it's not going to help us very much when we turn to those areas where we really do have good reason to cooperate, which include nuclear weapons and energy and a lot of other things.
Let's turn to the U.S., new administration in the U.S. for a moment. What do you see as the outlines and the innovations in Russia policy that are emerging already from this administration?
I think what you see in the case of the Obama administration is less a clear notion or a vision of the U.S.-Russia relationship and where they'd like to see it 4 to 6 years from now. One of the things we've been doing is urging them to develop precisely that kind of a vision. And we've done it with the chairs of the key committees in the Congress as well, that there ought to be hearings held on where we want the U.S.-Russia relationship to be 4 to 6 years from now and how do we get there. And for that matter, with the other countries as well. Where do we want the U.S.-China relationship to be 4 to 6 years from now, and how do we get there? We're at that point in the development of U.S. foreign policy where we need to do some very fundamental rethinking in Congress, in groups like this, in the media, in the undertakings that I'm a part of, and certainly within the administration. What I do see on the part of the administration at this point is an incipient strategy or a notion of how they want to proceed. And I think what you can see, I may be putting more of a fine point on it than one should, but I think it's accurate. The first thing they're doing is trying to affect the tone of the relationship and test the waters. And that's the reason for the stuff that you've been reading about, Vice President Biden in Munich talking about the reset button, this now famous metaphor that has not been well served by U.S. translators. And then some important visitors to Moscow that have laid things out in a relatively expectant way, without enormous detail on some key issues, including a superb person who will be at the center of the U.S.-Russia relationship, Bill Burns, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs in the State Department. He's the number three person, senior former ambassador to Moscow, absolutely superb on these issues. And then the tone or the quality of the meeting between Secretary Clinton and Foreign Minister Lavrov in Geneva. And you're going to see a continuation of that. What are we today? The 30th, in 2 days, on the 1st of April, when the two presidents meet for the first time. That is, above all else, going to be to try to convey a sense that the mood or the possibilities are changing in hopes that the Russians will reciprocate. And there are some signs that they already are in tentative ways, but I think we want to get back to the problems on the Russian side, why this might not work quickly. Secondly, then, overlaying that, if you will, setting of tone or testing of the waters is a readiness to move forward on some key, what I would call, time-urgent problems. The first and most important is finding some kind of progress on renegotiating or finding a new alternative to the START 1 treaty, which expires in December 2009, and without it, because it contains the verification, monitoring, all of the other critical counting aspects, the one remaining agreement that we still have, which has a 24-hour life in 2012, the so-called SORT treaty, is wasted, and all of strategic arms control collapses at that point, because that's the point we're at right now. We've had a 12-year hiatus or pause without strategic arms control, and that deadline is December 2009. The second issue is, of course, the question of Iran and nuclear weapons, and that's at least logically, if not in a negotiating form, linked to the question of ballistic missile defense in the Polish and the Czech republics, because the reason we're putting those facilities there are as a hedge or to guard against the threat from Iran and its nuclear weapons. And the third issue, which has already been engaged, and I think there'll be further conversation, I think it'll be a subject of conversation on Wednesday between the presidents, is Afghanistan and finding a way for larger cooperation, because we're going to need the Russians and the Chinese before we get out of Afghanistan. We're not going to be able to do it the way it's currently set up.
You've opened up so many topics here. Starting with the strategic arms control challenge, there has been an idea floated that the next round of strategic arms control would seek a level of 1,000 strategic nuclear weapons. There's also a debate going on among various factions in the administration and outside about going deeper than that. The Schultz, Perry, Kissinger, Nunn proposal to go try to go to zero nuclear weapons. Some people in the administration are saying that they really don't want to talk that way, they don't want to talk about that, set small objectives. That's Sam Nunn's approach, for instance. How do you read the administration's approach in this area? Was that just a trial balloon to go to a level of 1,000, seek a level of 1,000 strategic nuclear weapons? How do you see this developing?
In this next round, that the December 2009 deadline and whatever bridge is created to more substantial strategic arms control, the 1,000 limit will not be the early target, and there's a good reason for that. You can, right now, the range is 1,700 to 2,200. That's what's set by the SORT agreement. And so the question is going down below 1,700 warheads is what we're talking about. You can probably go down to 1,500, 1,300 without raising the problem that 1,000 raises. The problem that 1,000 raises is ballistic missile defense, because at that point you have to begin confronting the question of whether we are going to go ahead with ballistic missile defense. That in turn then raises the issue of national missile defense. The Obama administration, in the form of Obama, the presidential candidate, is on record raising serious questions about the wisdom of doing either national missile defense or ballistic missile defense to support theater missile defense in Europe and Asia, Taiwan, so on. But it's not a question that they're ready to sort out for themselves, let alone negotiate with the Russians in the near term. The relationship of all of this to the idea that was launched by the so-called Four Horsemen in the Wall Street Journal editorial more than a year ago now of eliminating nuclear weapons entirely, and that has been picked up by a series of governments, most vigorously by the British government and the British foreign minister, but other governments as well, and an idea that's endorsed by candidate Obama as well. He has said, I'm in favor of eliminating nuclear weapons. And Medvedev has also, at one point, said, I'm in favor of eliminating nuclear weapons. I'm much more skeptical about how sincere the Russians are about about moving down this path. That's driven by not stabilizing a nuclear relationship among the nuclear haves. That's driven by nonproliferation. Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and Sam Nunn did not think about eliminating nuclear weapons for much of the Cold War. They thought that was pie in the sky. They thought that was incredible naivete to think in those terms. But the epiphany is because of the risk of proliferation of nuclear weapons. Now, the question is, how then does that get reconciled with strategic nuclear arms control? And how seriously can you take the idea of getting rid of nuclear weapons? Their basic proposition is this is not going to be a safe world in dealing with proliferation until they're gone, until those weapons are gone, period. I think the first, in terms of the administration's commitment, I think they will be serious about disarming and lowering levels of nuclear weapons. They've then got to deal with a lot of technical issues, as I've described, beginning with ballistic missile defense. And before long, third forces, because the lower you go between the U.S. and Russia, then the sooner you've got to start thinking about French forces, British forces, Chinese forces, Indian, Pakistani forces. But on the non-proliferation side, getting rid of nuclear weapons as such, as Sam Nunn has often said, and as he said at the meeting in Washington on Friday, nobody's talking about helicoptering to the top of the mountain tomorrow. They're talking about one step at a time up a mountain. And the important thing is to begin climbing the mountain, not setting a dead date by which we're going to be there.
You mentioned Afghanistan, and you said that we're going to need the Russians in Afghanistan. How?
Unanswerable, because we don't know what they're willing to do. We know they would not be willing to put troops on the ground. We know, however, that they've had ideas along with the Chinese, and I always add the Chinese in this context, including potentially the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where they work together with the Central Asian states, in order somehow to reinforce the effort. At a minimum, it has to be in making it easier for us logistically to do what we intend to do in that area, rather than more difficult, which is what's happened recently in terms of Manas, the base in Kyrgyzstan, and Bakiyev's policy on that, the Kyrgyz leader, with Russian encouragement. But more broadly, they have been quite vocal about what's wrong with the political strategy, or even parts of the military strategy, whether they have a right to criticize the amount of civilian life that's been lost and the way the contest has been done is uncertain. But if they have ideas about how you can do it better, and the Russians do have some experience on making mistakes in Afghanistan, it would be useful to hear them out and include them. And then politically, in terms of the diplomacy, because in the end, like Iraq, this is an issue that's going to require regional cooperation. And in order to get, it's like concentric circles, in order to get that initial closed-in concentric circle to work, you need the next set of neighbors also to put pressure in the right way. And here I think the Russians and the Chinese can be useful, along with the Indians and others that have a stake, Pakistanis that have a stake, and how these things turn out. And the Russians and the Chinese in their relationship with the Pakistanis, for example, or even in some instances with the Indians, where it's less important because we have our own influence there. So that's really what I have in mind. And when I think about their role, I think about it as both political and military, and I wouldn't try to imagine what kind of a military role there could be.
You referred to the upcoming U.S.-Russia summit, presidential summit, and do you know anything about what's on the agenda for the summit, and what would you like to see emerge from the summit?
I do. They were working on as many as 3 statements that will be issued. I suspect they'll end up with maybe 2 statements, one of which this was not done as of Friday. A lot of work was being done over the weekend, and a lot of work will get done at the last minute because as they go back and forth with their Russian counterparts, it looks as though the Russians are on board for one thing, and then on the next day it turns out the Russians have got a different take on what's been agreed to and not agreed to. And often these statements, this won't be the first time, this is the regular history, these statements get finally worked out and settled at 3 a.m. on the day before or the beginning of that day. So I'd be reasonably certain that at 3 a.m. on April 1st, I hope not April Fool's Day, that they'll be working out the last details. That first statement, I think, will be on the issue, the big issue that we've already talked about. Where are we going on start one? And how are they in effect, what it'll be is an indication of what instructions they're giving to their delegations. And you'll get some sense of whether they have a common point of departure of the stuff that needs to be negotiated. Doesn't mean that they've agreed. This is not an agreement yet.
And the 3 areas?
Well, it'll be, the 3 statements. The second statement, were it to occur, would be a broader sort of tone-setting statement that I think will be done. It'll sort of echo the stuff that's been coming in a seriatim or in a fragmentary fashion from previous encounters, but try to pull some things together of what they'd like to do in the relationship. They've already had some conversations about what they'd like to see accomplished over the remaining 3.5 years of this administration. What the specific content of that is beyond Afghanistan and the Iran ballistic missile issue areas is not clear. I don't know what else they may have included. There are always a number of things they can take off the shelf where there could be cooperation. The other idea, which I think they're interested in doing, it's a good idea. I don't know how soon they'll be able to reach a conclusion on that. I don't think you'll see it announced at this meeting because, again, as I said, this is a get acquainted session where they're going to try to set tone. They're not going to suggest that as a result of this meeting we've resolved all kinds of problems and we've got a new set of agreements. That's not what's going to come out of this. Would be a process that we've strongly argued for and that the last Bush administration tried at one point. It petered out within about a year for a variety of reasons having to do with the general deterioration. And that is for the national leaderships to agree to a checklist of things that need to get done, which then is assigned in its specifics to the relevant bureaucracies with report-back dates that then get readjusted at summits between national leaders and then reassigned. I think this is an idea that the Russians were open to earlier. I think they're still open to it. I think the administration is playing with it. Whether it'll ever be public, and I doubt very much that even if it were to be public, that it'll be this soon, it is something that they are, again, thinking about. Because the bureaucracies on both sides need to be disciplined. Even if a policy gets set at the level of the bully pulpit, and even if there's an agreement to move forward and a set of negotiating frameworks that are set up, on START or even on energy or these other things, unless you have something like that, what goes wrong, not only in this relationship but in any relationship, is the way in which bureaucracies run off on their own unless disciplined.
It is, in fact, very true. If you have summit meetings and statements are made and policies are released, unless there is some regular process of follow-up and consultation, they tend to go nowhere. And you mention in your congressional testimony the importance of having an ongoing process of meetings and discussions with the Russians. There was the Gorchernomyrdin process during the Clinton administration. There have been bilateral working groups and so on. Is this administration beginning to put in place some of this regular communication as opposed to every year or two have a big meeting and then everyone goes home and nothing happens?
Without question. And they've been wrestling with the issue of who, at what level, and in what form they ought to go forward with something that looks like the Gorchernomyrdin Commission, which was at the vice presidential prime minister's level, prime minister on the Russian side in the earlier period. What we've argued for in the project is something a little different, and I don't know whether they'll go in this direction, and that is not merely for a Gorchernomyrdin Commission that would be a regularized set of meetings at that very high level, that could then take care of a number of outstanding issues that are not being successfully negotiated and figure out how you're going to deal with them. But a strategic, what we call a strategic dialogue that would be far-reaching, that would be decoupled from the negotiations, and its purpose would be conducted by people or a person who has the president's confidence, has the president's ear, to try to get at the fundamental impulses and concerns and assessments that are driving the positions of Russia on a series of very specific, hard, concrete issues like Georgia, Ukraine, and NATO, or like ballistic missile defense in Central Europe, or whatever else they feel about, whatever other set of issues, say, around Iran or otherwise. And that means getting back to what I call the framing issues. The framing issues for a problem like Ukraine and Georgia and NATO, or the next steps for NATO development, or dealing with an issue like the ballistic missile defense issues in Europe, is European security. That's the framing issue. And where are we going to go from here now that we've hit the wall? We know that the Russians have put that wall up when it comes to something like the next enlargement of NATO to include Georgia, Ukraine, and that simply is not in the cards in the near term. Medvedev, since early June, both in Berlin and then later in Evian, has been talking about a new European security treaty and a new kind of architecture by which you can reconcile the machinery in the West, the European Union and particularly NATO, with the machinery, security machinery that exists in the post-Soviet space, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the so-called Eurasian Economic Community, with great vagueness, because the Russians themselves don't know what they mean by it, and they don't even know whether it could be done. Lavrov at the Brussels Forum a week ago said that explicitly. But let's talk. Let's see what's there. And we believe that for this issue and three other issues, energy security, nuclear security and its complexity, and in the end, the really hard issue in U.S.-Russia relations, that we've always set to the side because it's too hard, yet it's central, absolutely central, is the interaction between the United States and Russia within the post-Soviet space. Until we begin talking about what is acceptable and what we find a potentially constructive role for one another within this space and a way to interact in ways that are constructive, this relationship's going to continually be buffeted by difficulty. And we think that needs to be developed in a strategic dialogue. That's a windy way of responding to your question about what further machinery do you need to develop continuity and develop some momentum in the relationship. The direct answer to your question is, on that second score, this administration realizes that full well. And they even at the next level down, and this is not easy to do in Washington, doesn't involve the Russians, it involves us. It is not easy to get a coherent interagency process underway in Russia and in the United States in Washington in government. And they're struggling very much with how you create an effective interagency process in Washington today.
Here's a provocative question from a member of the audience. The Kremlin appears to see the relationship between the U.S. and Russia as a zero-sum game. Russia's rise must equal U.S. decline, quote from an economist special report. How does the U.S. then approach Russia? How does one respond to this kind of policy or thinking?
It has certainly been absolutely characteristic of the deterioration that Gloria talked about at the beginning and that I that I commented on at the outset, that the Russian attitude toward the United States has become increasingly negative, increasingly skeptical, increasingly critical, critical of the conduct of U.S. diplomacy in the broadest sense, the commitment to unilateralism as the Russians see it, the early resort to military force and excessive militarization of U.S. foreign policy as the Russians see it, a lack of respect for the security interests of other states as they define it, as opposed to the way we would define it for them. And they put themselves at the forefront of this. They believe that most of this has been done when it comes to Russia out of intent to minimize or roll back Russian influence within its own part of the world, to diminish Russia in general. Whether that's right or wrong, and for the most part, certainly in terms of a conscious, coherent U.S. policy designed to do that, I think it is dead wrong. Nonetheless, that's the way in which they see the world. That's what then gives you this zero-sum quality, because the way in which you deal with that would be to change, would be to diminish the U.S. and its capacity to do all of those things. Now, what's the way out of the box? Well, if, A, they're either wrong about U.S. behavior, or since I think they're partially right about U.S. behavior in the past, if U.S. behavior changes, as I believe it is already doing in these circumstances under the new administration, then I think you'll see, especially if we begin to develop a more cooperative relationship with Russia, that that zero-sum game can very quickly be turned into a positive-sum game. And my prediction is we will see something, not without difficulty and not without stumbling and retreats, we will see something before the end of this year that looks much more like a positive-sum game, and I think the economists will be able to write a little bit differently about Russia.
For our listeners who cannot see us, this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Legvold, Professor Emeritus of Political Science from Columbia University, on U.S.-Russian relations. Let's talk a little bit about Iran, the Iranian relationship with Russia, the Iranian nuclear program. There's a question from the audience: does Russia have an active role in the Iranian race for a nuclear bomb? What are the expectations for this relationship going forward, strategic, scientific, financial, etc.? And I just add on to that, there has been, again, a proposal floated to for the U.S. to perhaps back away from the plan to deploy a theater missile defense in the Czech Republic and Poland, in trade or in relationship somehow to Russia's assistance with rolling back the Iranian nuclear program. Should those issues be linked? Is there a deal there? What do we want the Russians to do with regard to Iran? What would we hope for?
The Iranian issue is very complicated, and we end up with a simplified version of it in the press, and as a result, simplified impression of what's going on. I think the impression is that the Russians have simply not been helpful on the Iranian nuclear weapon question and therefore have been part of the problem. They've been enablers for the Iranians, even in an earlier stage because of their commitment to Bushehr, the light water reactor facility, and willingness to continue developing that, a sponsor of the program in some ways. All of that, I think, is quite inaccurate. The Russians do not want Iran to have nuclear weapons. That's not just a rhetorical posture. They mean that, not the least because they believe it's going to lead to further proliferation within the region, particularly within the Arab portion of the Islamic world in that part, and they really don't want to see that. But the devil is in the detail. So we don't disagree on ends. We disagree on means, how you get there. Why do we disagree on means? Well, I think that brings us back to the very different stakes that we have in the relationship with Iran as opposed to the Russians. We've had essentially three issues involved in dealing with Iran. The first is nuclear weapons. The second is their support for Hezbollah. And the third is the degree to which they've stuck wrenches in the spokes of the wheel of an Oslo process or any kind of Middle East peace process. The Russians have a 12-point agenda with the Iranians on everything from Caspian Sea oil and gas to the role of Shia in Tajikistan or the way in which Iran has played its role in Azerbaijan to access to, because Gazprom wants access to the gas fields in Iran. They're interested in arms sales when Iran thought it could afford to modernize its military forces. and general questions of stability within the region. So they've got a much broader agenda that they're trying to calibrate as they deal with the nuclear issue. Now, what are they prepared to do? First of all, there have been stages. I think at the outset, the differences over means had to do with, a sense of how urgent the problem was. We thought it was very urgent because we always calculated a much shorter time frame for getting to a nuclear weapon. The Russians have always had a longer time frame for getting there. They've also had a different notion, and therefore how urgent it was to put real pressure on Iran with sanctions. They've also had a question about how effective these tighter sanctions would be. But their own attitude on the threat has changed. It first changed 3 years ago when they suddenly found out that the accumulation of the centrifuge technology at Natanz was going forward. That surprised them. They thought that this was simply a domestic program, and they were suddenly alerted at that point that the Iranians probably were creating a capacity that went beyond that. And I can tell you that from the meetings that both Hagel and Hart and their people had with Medvedev 3 weeks ago now, and the meetings that Kissinger in the context of the Kissinger-Primakov group had with Medvedev week before last, that Medvedev is the one who raised not the question of the nuclear weapon, but the testing of the longer-range missile, and he raised it with some concern. Go read his BBC interview this week, which you can read in English, and you'll see that he's talking quite seriously about that. Now, to get to your question of what they're prepared to do in these circumstances, I think they're not certain that a new round of sanctions within the Security Council, and these concern primarily cutting off petroleum exports to refined petroleum exports to Iran, or these kinds of things are going to work. And I don't think they know themselves at this point what they're prepared to do. On the linked deal that you're talking about, they've made it quite plain they don't want to negotiate this. And again, in the BBC interview, he comes back to this. It's not, you can see he's trying to separate the two issues. The administration, the note, the letter from the president that Bill Burns carried to Moscow a month ago was misreported. That did not suggest a quid pro quo. We back away from the missile facilities and you put pressure on Iran. That's not the way it was phrased. It was phrased as a logical relationship. That is, if somehow we can make progress on the Iranian issue, then much of the urgency or reason for that defense goes away. It's not saying we want you to sign on to this with dates by which you're going to do this, and if you do that, then we'll do this by those dates. I think that relationship is sound. I never like the other kind of linkage, which I call apples and oranges, and we had it from a number of people who were so preoccupied with the Iranian threat that they were prepared to give up all kinds of things, not just give up the ballistic missile system, but promise the Russians that, no, we weren't going to go ahead with Georgia and Ukraine and NATO or a series of other things. In fact, one of them who thinks in these terms is a congressman from California, and at the House Foreign Affairs, so this is public, so I'm not revealing anything, at that committee meeting, he went on at how this is the single most important danger. We've got to put everything on the table with the Russians to get them to crack down until finally Howard Berman, another of your congressmen and chairman of the committee, said, and return Alaska. But those kinds of linkages don't make sense to me.
So just to back up one second, the connection between the two is if the Iranian nuclear program does not produce a nuclear weapon, then the need for a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe or Europe in general diminishes.
That's
because
right.
That would be one of the major threats. So
exactly. That's,
against which
we maintain
a
that's
shield.
Why we're building the system.
Right.
The Russians think that's not the full truth. They think it's a piece in a much larger international or global system. It is part of something which is called the global missile defense system that's going to have pieces elsewhere, and they think that is directed against them in the long run. Now, one other thing, if you want to talk about Iran, that I think is important, and Americans, I think, need to begin thinking about this because you'll see it, and there's some sentiment within this administration for moving in this direction. Apart from how much pressure you can put on Iran, I think there's a growing sentiment that we're not going to get the deal that we've put before the Iranians. We're going to have to put a different proposition in front of them. And rather than trying to roll them back and say that they will not have full fuel cycle capabilities, I think we're going to have to, in the end, and there are people in the administration that would argue this. In fact, Rose Gottemuller, the person I've mentioned, has a piece that she wrote some time ago suggesting this, that they will be given full fuel cycle, but fuel services will be internationalized, will be put under IAEA safeguards, and it'll be then part of a solution that has to be a general solution for a lot of other cases, not just Iran. Iran just is the first step in this, where we internationalize or multilateralize fuel services at key centers around the world, one of which is Angarsk in Russia. So again, Russia is important in terms of non-proliferation.
But her idea is fuel services, just so everybody understands, are enrichment, return of fuel rods.
The fuel gets supplied from this multilateralized center under international control, and then when it's processed, it's returned to that center. But the country, because we're going to have, it's now called the nuclear renaissance, we're going to have many countries that are moving toward domestic nuclear power, which always has this risk if they go on with enrichment to HEU rather than low-enriched uranium, which has the risk of creating a weapons-capable material. But the further idea, since if there are going to be these regional centers somewhere down the road, and down the road, it may be that it'll be in Iran. If Iran learns how to do this kind of thing properly and does it under international control, so that in the end, what we're doing is allowing them the nuclear facilities that they say they want, but we're denying them the capacity to actually turn it into a nuclear weapon. Right now, we're at a very different ballgame where we're saying, no, you've got to go back and meet all of your prior commitments. You've got to roll back everything you're doing. I think there are a lot of people now that are saying that's a non-starter. And I think, frankly, one of the reasons why the Russians are less cooperative is because they know it's a non-starter.
What's the most important lesson President Obama should learn from George Bush's relationship with Putin and the Russian government?
I know that's a reference to Slovenia and looking into the other guy's eyes and seeing his soul. It was good fodder for comedians and for those that want to be sarcastic about the president's mistakes. The administration, I think, in the end, in part because they, like the Clinton administration, in the end began to disengage from the relationship and allowed a lot of other people to begin defining what U.S. policy should be, was not the weakest part of their foreign policy. And if there was a strength to the policy, it was the relationship between the two men that allowed them to do a number of things they couldn't have done otherwise. And often the constraining influence at moments where the U.S. bureaucracy wanted to go off and really hammer the Russians, say after the color revolutions in Ukraine in 2004, culminating after the 2003 Rose Revolution, it was the president that took the longer range view and counted on his relationship with Putin, although it deteriorated over time, to keep the lid on. I would hope that these 40-year-olds who are now presidents of their country will develop a good working relationship, just as long as they don't have illusions, the notion that that's the end of the problem. It can be very useful, and it has been all along. It has been very useful back into the Soviet period, but it should not become the essence of the relationship, because it can't bear that weight.
Is it difficult for the 40-year-olds to bond and establish that relationship when there's a 60-something hovering in the background, meaning Mr. Putin? Or I've forgotten how old he is, but
he's still in
his 50s.
Yeah, yeah. The Putin Medvedev question is an interesting one, and people in the field. I'm looking at my colleague Gail Lapidus and others in the room. We go around on this a good deal. I'll tell you where I am on it right now. Increasingly, Medvedev is president of Russia. He's in no position to and would not challenge Putin on a major policy issue, or even look as though he's trying to undermine Putin. Because if Putin decided that was the case, I think he could cut him off at the ankles tomorrow. But increasingly, he thinks of himself as president, not as poodle. You'll see that in the interview. I also know from a private incident of somebody who went in, a Russian who went in to see him, who was invited in to provide advice. And when he came in, he said, "You know, Mr. President," he said, I'll do the following, but I don't want to presume on your schedule." And Medvedev looked at him for a few moments. He said, "Take as long as you like, but remember, you're meeting with the president of Russia." That was in private. So what he says in public that he's becoming president. And that's backed up by a series of things. It's backed up by the way in which he's defining an agenda and making it plain that he is also responsible, not exclusively, but he is also responsible for foreign policy, not again in a way that would be juxtaposed to or contradict Putin and where Putin wants to go on any major issue, but nonetheless as a real influence. Secondly, he is beginning to influence personnel appointments, and his appointments don't come from FSB, that is leftover KGB or the Siloviki, so-called Siloviki, or from the power ministries. They're lawyers, and he puts a lot of stress on the fact that he's a lawyer. He has stressed a lot the importance of rule of law. Now, sometimes it is a facade behind which he hides, so that when people say, how are you going to deal with Khodorkovsky in this next trial, his response is, it's going to be according to Russian law. That's hiding behind the law as opposed to supporting the law. But for the rest, including his anti-corruption campaign, which is in important respects going to fail, inevitably it will, I think he's genuinely serious about these kinds of things. So we'll see. My guess is that, first of all, the diarchy won't work, and it will be transformed sooner or later. The real question is whether it comes to a head and it produces a confrontation between the two, or whether it passes by in the normal course of things over the next 2 or 3 years on the way to the next presidential election.
Audience question. Pat Buchanan, in a recent column, posits that NATO is unnecessary since the demise of the communist empire and only incites Russian historic paranoia. Your view?
Well, Pat Buchanan's been calling America to come home for a long time. He doesn't want us to be doing much of anything in the outside world, including sustaining a NATO. I was an opponent of the original enlargement of NATO. I would have liked to have solved the security problem of Central Europe and the gray zones of Poland and Hungary, and ultimately even the Baltic states. That needed to be solved, but done it in a different way, in a more ambitious way, rather than doing the easy thing, because chickens come home to roost, to use a not very original metaphor. And I was opposed to it, not merely because I thought it was going to offend Russia and we'd eventually get to a point such as we are in now, over the post-Soviet space, because I thought it was going to do enormous damage to NATO. I thought the idea of enlarging NATO in this fashion was going to destroy an institution that was exceedingly valuable in modern European history for the military transparency that it's introduced into Western Europe, the cooperation among West Europeans, the resolution of the historic French-German relationship, and that would continue to give NATO a role that was appropriate to what the institution was. Even the idea, so the first opposition I had was to enlargement. The second was even to the notion of out-of-area missions, which I see now coming home in the negative way in Afghanistan. It's not, my authority on this counts for nothing, but there's an interesting essay that you may want to look at by General David Jones that's on the list for the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. On the occasion of the 60th anniversary of NATO, which will be April 4th of this week. And General Jones makes these points, that we're in the process of destroying NATO, not of saving NATO.
We're almost at the point of our last question. Before we get to that, I would like to mention that Professor Legvold is leading a Commonwealth Club trip called Imperial Russian Waterways that will involve a cruise on the ship, the Volga Dream, in Russia. He'll be lecturing to a Commonwealth Club trip coming up July 3rd to 16th of this year. So if you're interested at all, there are brochures outside, and we're delighted that he's able to do that. Now, the last question. It was recently alleged that Putin posed as a student during President Reagan's visit to Russia just to ask him challenging questions. To what extent does Putin still mask his intentions?
In the basis of the question, I don't know. If it's the 88 visit, I was there with Jennings for ABC and so followed most of what happened during the day, including the walkabout on Red Square. And I don't think there was a baby in the story, but I don't think there was a Putin in that story.
I've seen a photo that seems to show a Putin? Young Putin dressed in civilian clothes lurking about.
Unless Putin says, yes, I was there, I would still question it. But in any event, that's not the point of the question. The question is the degree to which Putin is a dissembler, and we ought to continue to be wary of him because of intentions that he's masking. That's what the question is all about. I don't think that's the case. I think Putin, if anything, shows, regrettably, increasingly shows his emotions and where he stands on these issues. Initially, when he did that, it was about a specific issue. It would be something like Chechnya in the early years. Otherwise, everything was very controlled. You see less and less of that now. If you watched his performance at Davos in the exchange with Michael Dell, in the question, and you see it now fairly regularly, the extent to which he shows his emotions. And somebody who's controlled and who's able to dissemble does a much better job of controlling his or her emotions.
Our thanks to our guest, Dr. Robert Legvold, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Columbia University and Project Director for a large study of U.S. policy towards Russia at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. We also thank our audiences here in San Francisco on television, on radio, and on the Internet. Remember, we encourage you to continue this conversation by joining us on the Internet at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. Tonight's program has been generously underwritten by Pitch and Canthy Johnson. I'm Gloria Duffy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth of California, celebrating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.